It probably comes as no surprise, given all the preparations that are going on for the upcoming week and weekend, that I have been moved to reflect on teachers and teachings. So I invite you this morning to identify some teacher, preferably a very wise one and a good one, who has had a profound influence on your life, and to invite them to join us today. Invite their spirit to sit with you, to sit with us today. Maybe you can even silently name that teacher. Whatever merit my words have, I dedicate to your teacher. So what was it that drew you to this person? It's interesting, they say that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And when the teacher is ready, the students appear. So it's a kind of mutual affair. It's a kind of mutual co-arising, codependent arising, teacher and student. And I've been reflecting on what it is that has drawn me to my teachers. And my first impulse was to think that I was drawn to them because they modeled some kind of perfection that I was aspiring toward, that they reflected some ideal that I was moving toward or I held in high esteem. They were kind of Buddhas. But as I looked more deeply into that question, why was I drawn to this teacher or these teachers, I realized that I was equally as much drawn to the way they suffered as to the way they modeled something that might be called liberation. That somehow my teachers suffered brilliantly. And they suffered in a way that kind of made them complete as human beings. And so I thought more and more that the teachers that I was drawn to really were full human beings. They were fully realized. They were real. They weren't just what I sometimes call stone Buddhas. They were flesh and blood Buddhas. They were wholly human, holy, H-O-L-Y, and W-H-O-L-L-Y, human. I remember one teacher that I had who visited Oon Zendo, where I practice in Pennsylvania. And he was my teacher at the time and led a weekend sesshin. And I was saying goodbye to him, walking him down to his car. And it turned out that he had misplaced his keys. The keys to his car. I was kind of all flustered. I started hunting around under the seats and the cushions, and we walked back to the house and to the Zendo and looking around for these keys, and he was becoming more and more distressed. And we went back to his car, and he had really kind of lost his composure. And he said to me something which was very curious. He said, "You go back to the house and pretend that I'm not here." Well, of course, I did that because I did everything that my teacher told me to do. But it struck me as very strange that he seemed to be embarrassed by his humanity. Zen teachers don't lose their keys. They don't lose the keys to their car. I was disappointed. I felt that something had been withheld from me, something very important. Namely, his humanity. I was not to see that. I was not to see that. And I've, over the years, come to discover that, well, there are many kinds of teachers, but I've kind of categorized them into two general areas. One is the withholding teacher. This was that teacher who withheld his humanity from me. And then there is the granting teacher. The teacher is always giving you, giving, giving, giving. And then the withholding. I sometimes speak of one as the rabbinical teacher. Sits on this ornate chair. Beard and robes. And all of the students sit there. And we just are privileged to overhear this person thinking. This is the withholding teacher, giving you wisdom, but withholding something else, not engaging. The granting teacher, I sometimes think of as Socratic. Socrates often spoke of himself as a midwife. Didn't give you anything, but helped you give birth to what you were carrying, your Buddha nature. Of course, he didn't speak of Buddha nature, but wisdom that we all carry and just need a little bit of skillful means to help it emerge. So over the years, I've discovered that the really good, maybe great teachers are the ones who do this beautiful dance between withholding and granting. Know when to withhold, when to grant, when to move away, when to approach. I had a really powerful lesson in this. One of our Sangha members at Owan had given birth to a baby girl, named Lucy. And when Lucy, she must have been about 9 or 10 months old, Mary Lou brought her daughter to visit Lucy. She presented me with Lucy, delighted to carry Lucy around. And I started doing what I used to do with my own daughter, just kind of carrying her around and say, Lucy, glass, Lucy, clock, Lucy, table. I was carrying around the room. Lucy, apple. And then I brought Lucy to the mirror. And I said, Lucy. Lucy. And Lucy had this kind of glazed look in her eyes. She was not registering her image. I used to do this as a kid with my cat, right? You used to put your cat up there and hope your cat would, you know, play with itself to your great amusement.
Run around behind the mirror.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. So I persisted. Look at Lucy. Look, there's Lucy. Isn't she pretty? Lucy, Lucy. Nothing. Lucy was just... Finally, I got it. I thought to myself, what am I doing? Do you know what I was doing? I was doing exactly what it is that we are all trying to undo. I was showing Lucy what a separate self she was. This is Lucy, and that's the world. So I had inadvertently, I'm so ashamed, I had inadvertently started to contribute to that very process of selfing. Oh my, that lands us into so much trouble. And here I was, just so naively trying to, look at this beautiful girl. Look how wonderful you are. And she was having nothing of it. She was just part of the world. She was not going to respond. Not yet, anyway. When she goes to school, maybe they'll push it hard enough so that she will begin to say to her mother, look at what Lucy did. Look at all the gold stars Lucy got. So I was feeling quite embarrassed and ashamed. Apologized to Lucy very quickly and thanked her for being my teacher. And over the years, I've come to realize that a really good Zen teacher goes around the way I did, and instead of saying, "This is a glass," says, "This is not a glass. This is not a clock. This is not a book. This is not... This is not Lucy." No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no mind consciousness. No separate thing. Totally reversing that process. And so, when the student hears this, and the teacher says, "Look, pay attention, no Mado," and Mado turns around and wants to thank the teacher for all of this wonderful insight and breakthrough, there's no teacher. There's no teaching. So this is the case of the disappearing teacher. Ultimately, the great teacher disappears. Wasn't it at his parinirvana that Buddha, everybody's weeping and they're leaving us? Of course, I'm a great teacher. You know, what were his last words? "Be a lamp unto yourself. Do not rely on others. Rely on yourself." Nirvana, what is it? It's disappearance. It's extinction. Of course your teacher is going to disappear. It's going to disappear continually. It's going to grant and withhold, and grant and withhold until there you go. And there he goes, or she goes. Both disappear. But some of us just want to grab. I know I do. I want to grab my teachers. Don't let them disappear. Many of us do that. We don't want to let our teachers disappear. In fact, when we say, "I'm remembering my teacher," remembering is actually reconstructing, remembering. Remembers. Rebuilding your teacher. Not allowing that to happen, disappearance, which is so critical to this practice. Especially with the withholding teachers. We don't want to watch them floating away. And many of us are in a lineage of floating away teachers. manage to get there. I happen to be one of those people in that lineage. I don't consider myself a floating away teacher. I'm too much of a granting teacher. And granting teachers, when they kind of get too granting, they become martyrs. That's the danger of being too much of a granting teacher. You sort of coagulate into a stone Buddha or a golden Buddha or a wooden Buddha or sometimes even a plastic Buddha. You know, there are different kinds of ways of coagulating. Becoming something less than human. So you know that eventually the stone Buddhas up there, you know, on the pedestal, you're going to have to throw them off that pedestal. And they're going to break into 100,000 pieces. Or the wooden Buddha. If you become a wooden Buddha, you're going to eventually, your students are going to burn you at the stake. Or if you are, what else did I say? Golden Buddha. Your students are going to wear your patina off, you know, until you just become dross. Pure scrap metal. And the plastic Buddhas will melt. But the flesh and blood Buddhas, they've got a chance of composting. So this is transformation. It's sort of a transformative process. But I tend to, as a student, I tend to want to fix my teachers. I want them under my control. Michael visited my Zendo Sangha. We did some ordinations. I think it was in May, wasn't it? Something. And he doesn't know this. This is a surprise to Michael today. But he had been using my computer. By the way, he's my teacher. He's my guiding teacher. One of those in the lineage of floating, cloud-like people who doesn't answer emails very well. Kind of last minute kind of thing. You know what I mean. I don't have to go into the details. I think you all have a sense of the floating cloud teacher type. Well, he happened to be using my computer and doing some very good work. It'll be published in was it Buddha Dharma magazine? But Michael, you forgot to sign out. Mm-hmm. So when I went to check on Owen's email, guess whose email came up? My teacher. All of his emails. Well, I turned the computer off right away and then turned it back on to see maybe this was a hallucination or something. It was a fluke. And no, it came back up. All of his emails. And I thought, this is a very interesting opportunity for me. to learn more about my teacher. And nobody would ever know. It's the wonders of technology. And maybe I would discover why he answered somebody's emails and not emails. Or what was really going on with his life? Because every time I ask him, he's like, oh, just kind of running away. Oh, boy. I was almost salivating. So I sat there in front of the screen. And I asked myself, what do I really want to know? What do I really need to know? And eventually my answer was nothing. And I signed him out. I have to say there's a little bit of... the possibilities were just very interesting. It was a good decision. I let you disappear. It was hard. Very hard. But I'm very glad I did it. So there is a collaboration between students and teachers. It's easy for a teacher when the student turns and wants to make the teacher a repository for this profound gratitude. It's easy for the teacher to become what we might call a guru. And there are those. I love Alan Watts's description of the guru. He's a person who picks your pocket and sells you back your watch. It's easy to become inflated because there's so much gratitude coming your way. So the teacher has, it's the practice of the teacher to disappear. And every, as the student pulls, the teacher has to resist. But not in a way that, in a way the extreme of the withholding teacher is the miser. Not the martyr, the miser. The one who gives nothing. So it's the middle way, the just right way. So pull too much, withhold. Become, and the student has to let the teacher go. Just has to let go. Go back into this dance. It's a beautiful relationship and very delicate and very hard. And right now I feel as if I should disappear, but I don't want to. I want to stay around and listen to your reflections and thoughts about your teachers. They're here with us.
Comes to mind is Coburn's statement that teacher-student relationship is too, like two vines that sort of twist around one another as they grow naturally. Mm-hmm. And yet, looking at the book, remembering Coburn, there are many, many vines twisting. Mm-hmm. different thought of the reality of a teacher, maybe.
Mm-hmm. With many. Many twists and turns within that mass. And how do you, maybe you don't separate, how do you untangle that? It's another metaphor, you know, sort of get twisted up with your teacher and maybe with other people who study with that teacher. So there's a sangha, too, a teaching group that is all twisted together. You kind of lose your separateness. You're just part of this beautiful bougainvillea. This sangha.
Well, you still have a relationship with your teacher, and it's always been long distance for you, isn't it?
Remote. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember you used to commute to Chicago.
Yes, but I was thinking about how accessible she always was to me, and we had a regular Dokusan every week,
mm-hmm.
and because she had this thing with phones, some of this energy conflict, the phones always died. I don't know if Michael was... But I never saw anybody who had as many phones or went through as many phones as she did. So we had this time. We would meet once a week on Friday. And if I couldn't make it for some reason or I had to, you know, adjust the time, I'd always call her and leave a voicemail. But so if she didn't answer her phone, I had three others to choose. Eventually, you know, she and I were very much in sync about our Dokusan. It was really quite special. Mm-hmm. For years, mm-hmm. we met that mm-hmm. way. And I actually had a chance to speak with her more that way than when I would go back to Evanston, mm-hmm. which was 4 to 6 times a year. And because I was competing with all her other students who also wanted to see her. And most of us she had a large percentage that were remote. So when we all came in together from Ohio and Wisconsin and Louisiana, California, and wherever we were all from, now even out east, it was really hard to get on the Dokusan list. Get a chance to see her once.
Mm.
So, but it was the one... observes whether or not, because I've known her for so many years, even before she was a teacher, so it was very interesting to see how long it took before I decided, yes, she is my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because she wasn't really ordained as a priest even at the time, mm-hmm. when I first knew her. So it was a very evolutionary
mm-hmm.
relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to the Dalai Lama's teachings, And one of the things that you said is like, you know, don't be in a rush. You don't have to have a teacher right away. Here, you're so fortunate in the West. You have books to read. You can go sample any number of traditions. There's no rush. You know, observe your, you know, a person and see if this is going to work for you. So I followed his advice and mm-hmm. observed my teacher for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But so she has been my teacher now since I think 93. But I've known her since mid-80s.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent it'd be interesting to hear from everybody else too. The significant teachers in our lives were not necessarily identified as teachers. Mm-hmm. They were not authorized as teachers, but they were deeply, deeply influential, and they taught us a great deal. And either they became our teachers, as in your case, or they were never formally, they never thought of themselves as teachers, but they... That's, you know,